Stephen Ford and Mr. William Butterfield will present arguments for the petitioner. Mr. Ford will open.
May it please the court, my name is Stephen Ford, and I, together with my co-counsel, Mr. William Butterfield, represent the petitioners in the case filed Triton Oil and Gas Corporation versus Marine Contractors Supply, Inc. I will give a brief statement of the nature and the history of the case and present one of the points presented in our application, and Mr. Butterfield will address the second point. This case is a suit brought by the petitioners, Triton Oil and Gas Corporation, against respondent, Marine Contractors and Supply, Inc., to recover on an agreement entered into by Triton and Marine regarding the drilling of a well in Lavaca County, Texas. The agreement provided that Triton would drill, complete, equip, and operate the well, and that Marine Contractors would in turn pay its pro rata share of the cost of such drilling and operations. The well was timely commenced and completed in the 7,200-foot Wilcox Formation in Lavaca County, and Marine, however, refused to pay its pro rata share of the expenses incurred. As a result of this non-payment, Triton filed this suit to recover the monies due and attorney's fees. Marine, Your Honor?
And interest.
And interest.
The agreement didn't have any agreement concerning interest.
The written contract did not have a provision for interest. That's correct, Your Honor. It's contention of the petitioners, however, Your Honor, that the burden was upon the respondents to prove that there was no agreement, and as pointed out in a recent case handed down by this court, Preston Farms, the agreement which is referred to in the article in question, Article 5069, Section 103, does not have to be in writing, Your Honor, and can be evidenced by conduct parties or otherwise.
You mean interest is to be had by the conduct of the parties, is what you said?
A specified rate of interest, Your Honor, could be agreed upon as evidenced by the conduct of the parties.
Strange contention to me, but go ahead.
This suit was tried before a jury in the 25th District Court of Lavaca County, Texas, and the findings of the jury on which the judgment of the trial court was based addressed the issues of Triton's negligence and attorney's fees and are not before this court. In addition to the amounts attributable to the jury's findings on the negligence issue, the trial court awarded Marine Contractors $89,629, which was the undisputed amount held by Triton Oil and Gas as Marine's pro rata share of the production, less the Marine's share of the cost of production of operation and drilling, and the interest due thereon. Both parties perfect an appeal from the judgment in the Court of Civil Appeals for the 13th Supreme Judicial District of Texas. Triton's 7 points of error, which addressed the submission of the 3 negligence issues, were overruled. Marine's cross point, which was directed to the trial court's refusal to find that Triton charged Marine usurious interest in violation of Article 5069, Section 103 of the Revised Civil Statutes of Texas, was sustained. With respect to the usury issue, the Court of Civil Appeals reversed the judgment of the trial court and rendered judgment that Marine recover $53,531.82 from Triton, being twice the amount of interest charged by Triton. From the judgment of the Court of Civil Appeals, respondent has filed this application for writ of error on 5 points, and such writ was granted on point number 5. Point number 5 addresses the holding of the court in the civil appeals that the petitioner charged the respondent usurious interest in violation of Article 5069, Section 103. Petitioners contend that the Court of Civil Appeals erred in its award of usury penalties for 2 reasons. First, that respondent has waived any grounds of recovery for usury. And second, that the agreement in question is not a contract ascertaining the sums payable, and therefore the 6% rate of interest provided in Section 1.03 is not applicable. I will address the first of these 2 grounds, and my co-counsel, Mr. Butterfield, will address the second. The first ground of reversal involves the very nature, Your Honors, of the claim of usury. Such a claim is made by the respondent for the sole reason of recovering penalties under Article 5069, Section 1.06, Subsection 1, which provides for forfeiture of twice the amount of interest charged or collected. This provision is intentionally harsh in order to act as an effective deterrent. However, the courts of this state have made it clear that in order to reap the benefits of these penalty provisions, the party asserting a claim of usury has the burden of clearly establishing the claim and all of the elements of such claim. Respondent asserts his claim of usury based upon the applicability of Article 5069, Section 1.03, which provides for a rate of interest equal to 6% when no rate of interest is agreed upon by the parties. It is clear that the 6% rate and the penalties for charging more than that rate are applicable only when no specified rate is agreed upon by the parties. Accordingly, it was incumbent upon the respondent to establish the absence of such an agreement in order to recover under the penalty provisions. Rule 279 of the Rules of Civil Procedure provide that upon appeal, all independent grounds of recovery or defense which are not conclusively established under the evidence and upon which no issue is given or requested shall be deemed as waived. In the case at bar, the ground of recovery for usury asserted by the respondents turned upon the applicability of the 6% rate of interest provided in Section 1.03, and therefore turned upon the absence of an agreement between the parties as to a specified rate of interest. No issue on the absence of such an agreement was given or requested. Furthermore, the evidence adduced at trial does not conclusively establish the absence of such an agreement. The record shows that monthly invoices were sent to the respondent, which clearly reflected that interest at the rate of 10% was being incurred on the past due account. The record also shows that the respondent never questioned or objected to that rate. Your Honor, it's the contention of the petitioner that due to the fact of the nature of this agreement and the nature of these agreements which are prevalent in the state of Texas, that the operator of such a well, in this case Triton Oil and Gas, had a lien upon the proceeds which were attributable to Marine Contractor's share of production, and that the parties were clearly on notice that this interest which was being incurred was being charged against their portion of production and was being taken directly out of such portion, which is tantamount to the payment of such interest charges. The conduct of the respondent, especially in light of the matter which I just discussed, unquestionably constitutes some evidence that there was an agreement between the parties as to a specified rate of 10% interest which would accrue on the accounts which were past due. The state of the evidence, together with the respondent's failure to request a special issue regarding the absence of an agreement, bring this case clearly within the provisions of Rule 279. The respondent has waived any recovery under its usury claim. A similar situation was presented to the Eastland Court of Civil Appeals in the case of Miles versus W.C. Roberts Lumber Company. The debtor therein attempted to recover the penalties imposed by Section 1.06, Subsection 2, contending that the 6% rate of interest that applied at a time when the creditor charged a rate between the rate of 10% and 20%. The Eastland Court, citing Rule 279, denied the debtor's claim, stating that Miles, the debtor, had the burden of establishing no agreement was made. No special issues were requested or submitted concerning an agreement. The evidence does not conclusively establish there was no agreement, and therefore Miles, the debtor, has waived any recovery under Article 5069, Section 1.03. Another opinion which directly bears on this issue was handed down by the Waco Court of Civil Appeals in the case of Capital Barber and Beauty Supply, Inc. versus Realistic, Inc. In that case, a creditor brought a suit on an open account and contended that it was entitled to recover interest at the rate of 6% under Article 5069, Section 103. That's correct, Your Honor. Your Honor, the issue here is the applicability of Article 1.03 and the 6% rate which is provided therein. As you have noted, the statute provides for the application of the rate in the case of open accounts and in the case of written agreements. Both of such applications, however, turn upon the absence of an agreement between the parties. The cases which I have cited deal with open accounts, and yet the issue before the court was the application of Article 5069 1.03 and the 6% rate. The case at bar, that is the issue before the court, the applicability of the 6% rate. And therefore, the principles that are laid down in these cases regarding the absence of an agreement, the burdens of proof, etc., are applicable in this case.
What rate of interest was actually charged?
10%. That's undisputed.
But you're arguing that 6% is applicable?
No, Your Honor. I'm arguing that 10% is applicable, that in order for the respondent to recover for usury penalties based upon the application of the 6% rate, it was incumbent upon the respondent to establish that there was no agreement between the parties and that therefore the 6% rate applied, therefore the penalty provisions applied. And it's position, the contention of the petitioner, Your Honor, that that was not conclusively established, that a fact question was not submitted to the jury in the form of a special issue on that particular fact, and therefore, under the auspices of Rule 279, the respondent has waived any recovery under its user claim.
That contention is necessarily based, is it not, on an extension of the Preston Farm versus Biozyme case, to the extent that where the creditor arbitrarily attaches an interest provision to an invoice and the creditor, the debtor, takes no action on it, if the creditor can find some means to offset that, then you can establish an agreement.
That is correct, Your Honor, and it is our contention that is not incumbent upon us to establish that the 10% rate applied.
So it was not it the 6% rate applied as a matter of law unless there's some evidence of an agreement.
That is correct, Your Honor. And it is our contention that there is some evidence of an agreement. Because there is some evidence in the record, and because the respondent did not request a special issue on that particular issue, that therefore the 6% does not automatically apply. The trial court refused to award usury penalties, therefore, and because there is some evidence of an agreement of 10%, the respondent has waived his recovery.
You really get down to the question of whether it's legally sufficient evidence of an agreement, do you not?
That's correct, Your Honor. And it's our petition that there is, in fact, some evidence of an agreement.
And that depends on an extension of the Preston Farm versus Biozyme theory.
Your Honor, Preston Farm, in my opinion, discusses the weight and sufficiency of evidence with respect to the billing of interest and the debtor's actions based thereon. In this case, that is exactly what we're addressing. The absence of any kind of objection or by the debtor, Marine Contractors, in light of the fact that its interest was being charged directly with this interest charge, which is, in our opinion, tantamount to payment of the finance charges. Back to my argument regarding Capital Barber case. The creditor therein attempted to recover or requested recovery of interest at the rate of 6%, stating that Article 5069, Section 103 was applicable. The court, however, denied such recovery, stating that the creditor failed to prove that the parties did not agree upon a rate of interest. The principle which is set forth in these two cases, Your Honor, the Miles case and the Capital Barber case, is clear. When a party wishes to avail itself of the application of Article 5069-103 and the 6% rate provided therein, whether it is in order to recover interest, as in the Capital Barber case, or whether it is to recover under the penalty provisions, as in the Miles case, the party who wishes to avail itself has the burden of establishing that there was no agreement between the parties as to a specified rate of interest. This principle, which petitioners contend is in complete harmony with the law of this state regarding other statutory penal provisions, is the principle upon which petitioners rely. Accordingly, petitioners pray that the judgment of the Court of Civil Appeals be reversed and judgment rendered that respondents take nothing under its usury claim. The second point of our raised in our writ of error will be discussed by Mr. Butterfield.
We'll hear further argument from the petitioner.
Please the Court. My name is William Butterfield, and I will briefly address petitioner's second contention under point number 5 and petitioner's application for writ of error. Petitioner would urge that the contract between the parties in this case is not a contract ascertaining the sum payable as contemplated by Article 5069, Section 1.03, and that as a result, such statute is not applicable, and the charging by the petitioner in this case of 10% interest upon amounts owed it by the respondent was not usurious. The contract between the parties in this case, Your Honors, provided only that they would share the cost of drilling and completing the Triton Ringer well situated on lands in Lavaca County, Texas. There is no indication whatsoever in the contract of the nature or the extent of the costs and expenses to be incurred in connection with the drilling of this well. In the case of Federal Life Insurance Company of Chicago versus Crichton, a 1923 Texas Commission of Appeals case with the judgment adopted by the Supreme Court, the court, in determining that a disability income policy was a contract ascertaining the sum payable under a predecessor statute to Article 5069, Section 1.03, stated as follows. It is sufficient to come within the meaning of the statute if the contract provides the conditions upon which liability depends and fixes a measure by which the sums payable can be ascertained with reasonable certainty. In the Crichton case, the policy contract set forth specific dollar amounts of coverage which would be payable to the policyholder if he became disabled or required medical treatment. On the other hand, in the contract between the parties in the case before the court, there is no discussion whatsoever, nor is there any measure by which the sums ascertainable thereunder may be ascertained. There is no discussion, for instance, of the total depth to be drilled in the well, nor is there a discussion of the estimated cost of the well based upon costs of wells drilled in the area. Further, there is no discussion of a possible dollar amount per foot which might be included in the drilling contract for the well in question. There are simply no means by which the sum payable pursuant to the contract can be ascertained. It's the petitioner's contention that with respect to the contract before the court, resort to it does not divulge any stipulated or ascertained amount to be expended by the parties in the drilling of the Triton Ringer well. It is necessary to go outside the contract to ascertain the sums due and payable thereunder. Accordingly, the petition would urge that the contract before the court is not a contract ascertaining the sum payable, as a result of which Article 5069, Section 1.03 is simply not applicable. The petitioner further submits that since the contract is not within the purview of Article 5069, Section 1.03, that the petitioner was not limited to charging the 6% interest rate which is provided for in Section 1.03. Would direct the court's attention for just a moment to Article 5069. Section 1.01 defines usury as interest in excess of the amount allowed by law. Section 1.02 states in part as follows, except as otherwise fixed by law,
The maximum rate of interest shall be 10% per annum. A greater rate of interest than 10% per annum, unless otherwise authorized by law, shall be deemed usurious. And Section 1.03 of Article 5069 limits the maximum rate of 10% provided in Section 102 to 6% in two specific areas, number one being open accounts, and the second being contracts ascertaining the sums payable. Inasmuch as the contract between the parties in this case is not a contract ascertaining the sum payable.
That contract doesn't provide for interest either, does it?
No, ma'am, it does not.
So you can't recover. The interest then would not be in agreement between the parties as a result of the contract between the parties.
There was no, well, Mr. Ford has argued that there was very possibly an agreement for the charging of 10% interest. The written contract itself does not provide for interest, no. And it's the petitioner's contention that inasmuch as the contract before the court is not a contract ascertaining the sum payable, the limitations of Article 5069, Section 1.03 simply do not apply, and the petitioner was allowed to charge the maximum interest rate allowed by law in Section 1.02 of 10%, which is the interest charge that was made. The court's attention is directed to the case of Matador Sales Company, Inc. versus the Wells Companies. This is a Houston Court of Civil Appeals case, 1979, with a writ refused, no reversible error. In this case, the trial court entered a summary judgment against the plaintiff that the plaintiff take nothing, but the court also held that the plaintiff had charged usurious interest based upon an oral contract for the payment of commissions. After determining that no written contract existed between the parties, and after quoting Article 5069, Section 1.03 in full, the Court of Civil Appeals stated as follows. Therefore, we do not regard such statute applicable in this case, statute referring to Section 1.03. There being no written contract in the record ascertaining the sum payable and volunteer, nor did appellee agree in writing to pay interest to appellant. The usury penalty provisions in Texas Revised Civil Statutes, Article 5069, 1.06, have no application here. The facts in the case before the court this morning, Your Honors, are as in the Matador case. There is not a contract ascertaining the sum payable, as a result of which Article 5069, Section 1.03 does not apply. For this reason, the plaintiff was allowed to charge interest at the maximum legal rate of 10% per annum under Section 1.02 of Article 5069. Inasmuch as there was not interest charged above the maximum rate allowed, the penalty provisions of Article 5069, Section 1.06, are simply not applicable in this case. Accordingly, the petitioners would urge this court to reverse the judgment of the Court of Civil Appeals and render judgment for the petitioner on his point 5 as set forth in its application for writ of error.
The argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Lance Winchester will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, I will not address in my argument the points raised on any of petitioner's requests for writ of error, except on the usury point and the waiver point that they've raised. I think that the Burke Royalty case hopefully has laid to rest their contentions that the plaintiff waived the negligence issues by failing to more specifically plead them. I would like to address first the waiver point because I really believe that that is the guts of petitioner's claim, and I believe that's the important part of this case. That is whether or not I presented sufficient evidence to present a prima facie case, and number two, whether there was any disagreement or whether there was a dispute at trial as to whether there was an agreement. Now, there is a written agreement in the case, petitioner's exhibit number one in the trial of the matter, wherein my client agreed to pay one-third of the cost of drilling and completing this well. There was no provision whatsoever for any interest. Petitioner sued originally on the written contract, made no allegations that there was any oral agreement or any other agreement other than the written agreement. There were a number of counterclaims and answers filed back and forth, which culminated in May of 79 in a supplemental petition that I filed alleging that they had charged more than the interest allowed at law and therefore became subject to the 5069-106 penalty provisions. Petitioner never filed any type of avoidance or affirmative defense as required by Rule 93. Furthermore, on the presentation of the respondent's case at trial, it was very clear through the testimony set forth in my brief of Mr. Roger Evans on behalf of Marine Contractors that the written contract was the only agreement in the case and there were no others, and furthermore that he had never agreed to pay any interest. Now, the question then becomes, did they, the petitioners,
counsel it to help me if you'll call me by name?
Yes, Your Honor, I will do so. The question really then becomes, did Triton raise legally sufficient evidence to constitute a fact issue as to whether there was some other agreement? Counsel for Triton seeks to argue that there were two such possibilities. Number one, in his brief, he does not argue it in oral argument, but in his brief he says that when Mr. Jake Goodson, Triton's vice president for finances, testified, he was asked a series of questions which amounted to essentially, number one, did Mr. Evans ever object to the interest you showed on your invoices? Answer, no. Did he ever pay him? Answer, no. I think, and my petition of the position of Marine Contractors is, that number one, had this case come up on a summary judgment prior to trial, and had the affidavits and other sworn pleadings said exactly what is brought out in the statement of facts in the trial of this matter, I would have been entitled to a summary judgment in that they have not raised legally sufficient evidence to require the submission of a special issue to the jury, and I would have been entitled to a judgment as a matter of law, there being no dispute as to the contract providing no interest. Now, what they then seek to argue in the second alternative is that, well, the other possibility for them having raised the evidence is that unilaterally and arbitrarily they withheld all the runs on this particular well, which were due and payable to Marine Contractors, they being Triton. And they argue that by them being the operator of the well, receiving all the money and then withholding it, that we have somehow paid the questioned interest. They're attempting to bring this within the scope of the Preston Farms case decided last year by this court. This court specifically refused at that time and said that, rejected their position, I think, and said that we stopped short of saying that the mere sending of invoices, unless accompanied by some other action, can constitute any type of agreement to pay the interest. I think Preston Farms applies in that language, but doesn't apply in another part of the language. That is, the usury statute, and I use usury loosely. There's some confusion in my own mind about when you talk about usury or interest greater than that amount required by law. The written contract here has no interest provision. Preston Farms was a sworn account case. In fact, every case cited by Triton in support of their position is a sworn account case and not a case where they had a written contract, number one, and then alleged some oral or side agreement or agreement by implied contract. I don't believe the evidence is sufficient in this case to raise that issue, legally sufficient. Therefore, I am not required, and Marine Contractors was not required, to submit any special issues to the jury. Now, the second issue they raise is that the sum could not be ascertained from the written contract. And I think the court's opinion in Phillips Petroleum versus Stahl answers that. In the Phillips Petroleum case, it was a very complex oil and gas agreement, but the operative terms were that the prices charged were to be based upon the weighted averages of all gas received by Phillips Petroleum during a month. And I think under the same reason this court used in Phillips, the contract before this court in between Marine and Triton is one ascertaining a sum payable. That is, at the end of the month, you figure out your expenses, you divide by three, and you have what Marine was supposed to pay. A much simpler process on its face than was before this court in the Phillips Petroleum case. Triton takes a very interesting position to me, and I think it's most clearly pointed out in the amicus curiae filed in this case. On the one hand, we have a written agreement ascertaining a sum payable, but which has no interest provision. They go to trial contending that is the agreement, and my client is liable to them for one-third of $400,000+ in expenses, and then seek to bootstrap their way into an argument that, well, we really didn't mean that that was just the agreement. There really was some other agreement, which they never claimed. There's not one shred of testimony from their side of the case to the affirmative. That is, Mr. Jay Goodson, was there another agreement? Well, certainly. Mr. Evans agreed to pay the interest. There was no affirmative act by Marine Contractors and Supply to pay any interest. Unlike the Preston Farms case, where after receiving invoices clearly stating the interest, the person seeking to hold the penalty provisions against the bio company went ahead and paid them. There was a course of conduct under the UCC providing an implied agreement. Now, if they're right that this is not a contract ascertaining a sum payable, then under the usury, and I use that word loosely again, the usury statutes being 5069, 1.01, and that sequence, they're not entitled to recover any interest if they're right on that contention. Which, of course, I disagree with that. I think it's a contract ascertaining a sum payable. The law, to me, has been very clear that unless you're entitled by a statute to recover interest, you can charge none. If they're right that there's no written agreement, I mean that there's a written agreement but not ascertaining a sum payable, then they're not entitled to interest. If they're wrong, and it was a written contract ascertaining a sum payable, then they're only entitled to charge 6%, which I contend on behalf of Marine. Therefore, Triton charges 10, which is undisputed, and therefore becomes subject to the penalty provisions of 106. That's why I said earlier in my argument that either way you take Triton's argument as to whether it's ascertained a sum payable or not, they lose. I believe the issue is really turned on whether they sufficiently raised the question of agreement during the trial of this matter so as to require Marine to get a special issue, an affirmative answer from the jury on a special issue. I don't believe they raised it. This court's opinion in Preston Farm indicates that you are stopping short of saying that the mere receipt of invoices followed by no further action such as payment would constitute any type of agreement. The usury statutes...
Even if made counsel, is it your position that you would have to, that it would be your burden to get a jury finding that there was no agreement?
No, Your Honor, I really don't believe that. I believe that would be a defensive issue, which if it were raised, they would have the burden of getting the defensive issue that there was an agreement. I alleged a written contract ascertaining a sum payable, which contained no provision for the payment of interest. I believe if they're going to raise an affirmative defense or avoidance, they have to do it under Rule 93 to start with, and then they have to not only plead it, but they have to then prove it at trial by some legally sufficient evidence.
The burden would be on them to get a binding of an agreement.
That's what I think, Your Honor. But I don't believe it matters in this case, frankly, because I believe that, number one, it wasn't ever disputed that there was no agreement. I don't believe the evidence they offered to contend there was no agreement is legally sufficient to raise that issue, so that I would then have to get a special issue on any question of that. I believe it's the facts are clear that there was a written agreement, no agreement to pay interest in the written agreement, and that they charge more than allowed by law, that is 10% instead of 6%. So I think it's a defensive issue in answer to your question. Had it been properly pled, had it been properly raised, I think they would have had the burden of going to the jury with a defensive issue, just as the party did in Houston, Sash, and Door when they wanted to contend Houston, Sash, and Door was a plaintiff, so they would be contending that the other side was guilty of usury. It's a defensive issue. It's the burden of the party claiming some other agreement to prove it. Such as in the Preston Farms case, Your Honor, where you have the implied contract. Payment of the invoices after receiving the invoice stating an interest. I believe it's the party claiming that there is some other agreement to raise it by pleadings, evidence, and issue, special issue.
What was the nature of the accounting between Triton and Marine as to how much was being withheld of Marine's money?
Your Honor, if I understand the question, it's the answer to it is twofold. Number one, they sent out a standard invoice which on the front of it delineated the things they had done. They had tremendous problems in this well getting those pipes stuck, and they had to have workover rigs on the job for several days, and that would be clearly delineated. There would be a charge for that at the bottom of the invoice.
But what I really had reference to was evidence that Marine acquiesced in payment of it.
Okay.
Did Triton ever forward any money to Marine?
No, Your Honor. They withheld 100% of the runs on the well. Not just the, they didn't, you see, the well was producing at the time of trial $10,000 to $12,000 per month net to my client. They were withholding every nickel of the monies and not forwarding any.
Had Marine's share of the proceeds of the well exceeded one-third of the cost of drilling the well? In other words, was there any net amount due you?
Yes, Your Honor, there was a tremendous net amount, which was the subject of the conversion claim in my counterclaim in that suit.
Had any of this evidence, any documents that Triton had sent to Marine indicate this 10% has been charged?
Yes, Your Honor.
Your share of the proceeds?
What they did was they, number one, withheld all the runs, sent out the invoices, and in the upper right-hand corner of every invoice, they would indicate that there was an interest rate charged. They would not, as I recall, they would not specify the amount of the interest, but they would put at the top of the right-hand corner a certain interest rate. Interestingly enough, a couple of them even said 12%. But mathematical calculations at time of trial, it was really 10%, even though it said 12. But, and that is exactly what they did in Preston Farm, except that then the party voluntarily sent in money. It was a sworn account case. It wasn't like this with there was a fund of money being held. In Preston Farm, they sent an invoice. The guy picks the invoice up. He reads it. He sees the 10% or whatever the percent was in Preston Farm. He writes a check back, which includes the interest payment.
And continues to order more fees and continues.
It's exactly right, John. And then he continues to order it knowing they're charging him interest. And the court's opinion, basically, as I read it, was that this is under 2.207 of the Business Commercial Code. This constitutes an implied agreement to continue paying it. And that's totally different. I hope I make that clear. I think I have so little to say. I think the case really turns on the waiver issue. I really think it does.
Counsel, I'm sure you said this, but in your claim over against Triton, you alleged negligence. Did you allege in your pleadings that they had charged interest?
Your Honor, in my...
various interest?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did you allege it?
Yes, Your Honor. I raised it in my supplemental petition. In fact, I think it was, plaintiff of defendant's second amended answer and counterclaim was in, if I'm not mistaken, let me check it, Judge, I had it cited in my brief. In May of 1979, I raised the question of usury, charge of interest greater than the...
You raised it by pleading?
Yes, Your Honor. And they failed to file in. There to date has been no responsive pleading filed to that. No denial, no general denial, no affirmative defense, no avoidance of any kind. And I proceeded then, Your Honor, in the trial of the matter to ask, which is again cited in my brief and quoted, ask the representative of Marine on two different occasions, is this the agreement which was already in evidence being the written agreement they sued upon? Answer, yes. Next question, is there any other agreement? No. Did you ever agree to pay any interest? No. And the only rebuttal evidence, if it be construed as that, I frankly don't think it raises any issue. I mean, I didn't even, in the trial of the case, when they asked, did he object to it? Answer, no. Did he pay it? Answer, no. To me, that wasn't disputed. We didn't object to it except by, you know, proper pleading in the case that was pending and by the trial of the matter. So I think the case is...
It really wasn't owed. He didn't pay it because they deducted it.
No.
Didn't they deduct it from the runs?
Well, that was... Yeah, they did deduct it from the runs, Your Honor. But we claimed, of course, see, they were deducting the expenses and also the interest. And our contention was, under the negligence claim and the conversion claim, that because of Triton's negligence on the well, the expenses had gone sky high, and we had been forced to pay way more than we should have. And furthermore, that they had damaged one of the other. There were two potential producing zones on this well, Your Honor. And our position was that negligently they had increased the expenses on the drilling of the well, and furthermore, they had damaged one of the producing zones so that from this particular well there could be no production obtained. We are not contending, Your Honor, that we ever paid that. In fact, we contended we didn't.
In other words, they held out the 10% plus everything else.
That's exactly right, Judge. They were the operator on the well, and as an operator, they received 100% of the proceeds and then write checks out to the other overriding interest and other interests held in the well. And when they didn't write any checks to my man, they withheld all the expenses he was supposedly due. They withheld interest they were charging with no agreement to do so, and they withheld any overage.
And your contention is that you sued them not only for that 10% plus the rest of the override.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think I very clearly set that out in about three different pleadings. The last thing which raises the usury question is in the supplemental petition, supplemental pleading, and I forget exactly what it's called, but...
The bankruptcy was not effective, and Mrs. Day still has a 12-5 judgment against Mr. Day. But she can't find any property except his separate property, which he's now claimed as his homestead, to enforce that. But our contention is that the statute, Article 5449, Paragraph A, is very clear that the judgment creditor is discharged by bankruptcy. We did get into this situation arising from the Mr. Day's attempts to prevent, to avoid contempt and to preserve the subject matter of the appeal. Our primary allegations in Tyler for the writ of prohibition were that all contempt proceedings should be held in the Tyler court, if at all, and that the subject matter of the
of the appeal should be preserved. And the court went further in consideration of a previous motion to dismiss for want of jurisdiction. Mr. Adams' suggestion that that it might be proper to return this case to the Court of Civil Appeals of Tyler to consider the, in the interest of judicial efficiency, to consider the other issues which we raised on appeal, points of error, were not limited to the jurisdictional issue. There were 7 points of error of which the jurisdictional issue was before. So I would suggest that the, first of all, the Court of Civil Appeals of Tyler be affirmed, and that secondly, if not affirmed, that it be remanded for their consideration of any further issues that might be considered before it possibly comes back to this court.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal argument from petitioner.
Clearly made to the court commission. We have from the domestic relations court an equitable lien within the four corners of the judgment. That judgment was not abstracted. It did not become by abstraction a lien upon all the property of Mr. Day.